There are a lot of scriptures in the Bible that deal with warfare, especially with our being a part of the Christian army, part of the Lord's army. And in the sense we're in a fight with three foes, I have mentioned this numerous occasions, we're in a fight with the world. And the world's always giving us their expectations of what we ought to be. You see this today in what's called being politically correct. That is saying we are giving you our expectations of what we think you ought to be as you live in the United States of America. How you should think, how you should act, how you should dress, what you should do, what you should not do, what you should believe, how you should practice. They're going to tell us what they expect us to be and do and follow. And you don't fit in to our society if you do not go along with them. And so today there are a group of people who are fighting the expectations of what is known as politically correct. There is the warfare that we have always with the world. The world, in a sense, did not let Jesus alone. They picked on him, and the religious world is some of the worst. Secondly, we have a fight with the flesh, which lusts to do that which is forbidden by the law of God. And that's a continual battle. And then we, last of all, and what we're dealing with tonight, we have a fight with the devil, which is designed, I believe, to make us a burden to God. Satan does not want God to have any joy derived from this earth. Now, he can get joy elsewhere, and had God decided to annihilate Adam and Eve, he would not have diminished his joy. All right? But there is a joy supplied to God by those on this earth who choose to worship and follow and obey him. Satan does not want God to gain that kind of joy, that source of joy. He wants to deprive him completely of that joy and instead make those who follow him to become a burden. A child can be the joy of your life, or the child can be the heartbreak of your life. And the Satan's desire is to make every one of God's children, which have been taken from his family and placed in God's family through conversion in Christ, he wants them to be deprived, or God to be deprived, of any happiness from those children. He may call them his children, but he wants them to be a burden and a grief and a sorrow to God. He also wants them to be an embarrassment to God. Now, I'm not talking about the lost, because they don't have a warfare with Satan. They're part of his force. But we as Christians can be an embarrassment to God, and that's what the devil wants. Oh, you call him your child, just look how he's living. And so God, his name is dishonored, and in a sense, because of that. And then, thirdly, Satan desires to make us good for nothing to God. We are supposed to be God's hands and eyes and arms and labor and force and strength. We're to carry out the Lord's orders on this earth. We are, in a sense, serving Christ. And Satan desires that that element of service be taken away from him, which breaks down God's method of operation. God will bless this world through us. If Satan removes us, what's God going to do? The channel of delivery has been stopped. And so Satan says, I can, in a sense, do my best to make the Christian absolutely useless. And that's, I get kind of back on this because it bothers me. Tonight, most of the people are useless to God. They're an embarrassment because they're choosing something over God. And Satan says, look there, God. I take note of that. Do you take note of that? And it's a burden, you know, when a man chooses to go somewhere else instead of come home to his wife, especially another woman. Now, that causes a burden. And I don't know how you feel, but I sort of feel like God feels in a situation like this. And it bothers me because I think God is truly hurt. I think God is truly grieved. And I really think Satan is behind a great deal of it. I think the world is. And I think the flesh is. Flesh has got something else tonight it would rather do. But the point is, the Christian surrenders and does not fight and does not win, and there's no excuse for this. Now, in 1 Timothy 1:18 and 19, we have one of the texts. There are a number. I'm not going to read all of them. But 1 Timothy 1:18 and 19 is one that deals with the subject of our being a part of the army of the Lord. Verse 18, he says to Timothy, I charge you according to the prophecies that went before of thee, that by them you might war a good warfare. Implying, I believe all of us, like Timothy, are caught up in this warfare, whether we want to be or not. Therefore, fight a good warfare, hold your faith. That's one thing Satan wants to take away from you. Hang on to a good conscience, which some have put away concerning faith and have made shipwreck. They've been wrecked on the rocks, on the reefs, so to speak. They did not warfare, and they did not win, and they lost. 2 Timothy 2:3. 2 Timothy 2:3. He says, thou therefore, again talking to the same young man, Timothy, thou therefore endure hardness. You got to get tough to be in the military. Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So we may be given a lot of titles like sheep, believers, but here's one that a lot of folks don't want pinned on them, and that is that they're a soldier of the Lord. Then the last one is Ephesians chapter 6, because that's where we're going to spend most of our time. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13 is the first verse I want us to look at, for tells us about the warfare. Take unto you the whole armor of God. This is addressed to the church at Ephesus. Take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, having done all, to stand. The implication is this battle will not be easy, and it's going to take great effort on your part to stand and to win the battle. And we'll focus the majority of our attention on Ephesians 6 because he explains the warfare armor that we're to put on. And it's the main passage in the New Testament on the subject of spiritual warfare. Now, Paul does not deal in this text with warfare with the world nor with the flesh, but only with the devil. And he identifies these as, in a sense, being an army. He doesn't use that term, but because of the word armor, that's a military term. And he says here in verse 11, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. And then in verse 12, he gives you sort of a breakdown of Satan's military establishment, organization. He says, we wrestle not against human beings. Our biggest warfare is not with people. Although you do have some problems with the world. That's where the people are. But we have instead a battle against, he calls them principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. He calls these spiritual enemies, powers, rulers, and spiritual forces in high places. All of these refer to I believe, organization of fallen angels. Some may call them demons, but all of them, I believe, are fallen angels. They are spirit creatures. We are spirit and physical. And we operate in the realm of the physical, and that's what makes you and I unable to see the spirit. Those in the spirit can see the physical and the spirit. We cannot. I have a spirit, and I cannot see it. When I die, my spirit and my soul, which I cannot see, which do exist, which can be seen, will be seen by my spirit at that time. I will see me. Sounds so strange. I will see me for the first time. Don't know what I'll look like. Maybe I'll have some hair. I don't know. But anyway, I will see me, the Spirit, for the first time. But God can open my physical eyes and let me see the spiritual if He wants to. Elisha had his eyes open and he saw the angels surrounding the city. And he told God to open the eyes of his servants so he could see the angels. And sure enough, they were there. You see, well, are there any spirits here tonight in the church? I believe there are. I can't see them. I know you can't see them. Every angel of God is a spirit. But I could be enabled to see them. My eyes could be on. God even opened the eyes of a donkey in the Bible and he saw an angel. So it can be done. Yeah, but I have not the ability to open the eyes of anyone to see an angel. Are there any evil angels here tonight? I don't know. You say, well, can we run them all out? I know people try to, you know, a devil get out of here. I don't know if we could do that. One may be invited to stay here by you. He might be living with you. And he may not have any reason to leave. And I'm not sure I can tell him to go if you don't want him to go. You may even invite him to come in with you. I just don't really know. But I'm saying there is a force of evil spirits. And they're real. But I, because of my physical limitations, cannot see them. So they're invisible to my eyesight, but that does not mean they do not exist. The Bible tells us there are angels. And of course, I have only the Bible to go on, since I have no way to verify it. Well, I have never seen an angel. My mother says she did, but I never have. I would like to see one. Now, we sometimes talk about and sing about desire to look into the face of Christ. And I can understand that and agree with that. But have you ever had a longing to look into the face of an evil spirit? I wouldn't mind seeing an angel. I want to see my angel have wings. So I don't want one that doesn't have wings. You know, Abraham was sitting at his, I believe, tent door, and two angels walked up. And he thought they were just men coming to visit. And he said, fix some dinner for them. I want an angel with wings. I want the real thing. Well, they're all the real thing, but I want one that's got wings. Seraphims and cherubim have wings. And the others, I don't guess they do. Well, they can take them off. I don't know how that works, you know. But anyway, have you ever desired to see the face of an evil spirit? Of a fallen angel? I don't think I'd like to see one. I have a friend who was a preacher who said one night he was asleep and he woke up and he felt this strange feeling in the room. He couldn't quite, just felt very uneasy. And he said he sat up in the bed and he looked all around and he couldn't see anything. Why he was so upset, he didn't know. And he got, all of a sudden at the foot of the bed appeared this creature. I'm just telling you what he said. I have not had this stuff verified. I don't want to see this creature. He can stay over there. Don't come over here and see me. I don't materialize. I just simply say invisible. But he said it was a horrible looking creature. And had a horrible stare of hatred in his eyes. And he said it really frightened him. And finally it went away. But I can't verify what an evil spirit looks like. But I tell you this. I think we might be better off if we did see the face of the fallen angels that hovered around us. No matter how frightened we might be, I think we might be better off. It might be easier for me to get interested in warfare if I heard what these evil spirits were saying to each other. Or if I could hear what the goal or the mission of this evil spirit was that's come to harass me. If I could figure out his plans and his plots. If I could see all that information, if I could hear these evil spirits talking, if I knew what the orders from headquarters were, I think I might really get interested in spiritual warfare. If I knew what they were cooking up before they cooked it, I don't think I'd be so inconsiderate or unconcerned. So it might not be a bad idea. Maybe one of them, you say, well, you want to hear, we'll come tell you. So I don't know. But I'm just saying it might really create an alarm in us if we knew what was being plotted against us. At least we would see them as our enemy. At least we would see that we are under their observation and they have something planned against us. At least we would probably do more to fight them than we do now. At least we would probably run to Jesus for help quicker than we do now. We wouldn't wait till we were pounced on, unprepared, and then try to do battle in that situation. I think if we did see the enemy, there'd be one thing that would truly surprise us. If we saw him after we had a battle, and we had won. Now, usually when you see a battlefield scene, and one side has defeated the other, you go over and you see the other side, and they're wounded, and they're bleeding, and they're dying, and they're crippled. And you know the victor sort of feels his pride and arrogance. Well, boy, we tore you up. But if you could see the evil spirit after you won a spiritual victory, you wouldn't see that kind of scene. You wouldn't see him weakened one bit. You wouldn't see him frightened of you any more than he ever was. You wouldn't see him one bit discouraged. You would not see him about to quit. You would not see him frightened of you. What you might see would be he would go in and get some help to come back and do it again and fight you. Then Jesus talked about the demon cast out would go away and get some more demons and come back and you'd have more trouble than you ever had. And so you don't see this defeated aspect on the part of the devil. That might surprise you that he would come back and back and back. Why not? What does he have to lose? Nothing. You have a character, you have a soul, you have a spirit, you have a reputation, you have a conscience, you have health, you have blessings, you have so much to lose. What does the devil have to lose if he loses in a battle to you? Nothing. Not one thing. You haven't inflicted any pain on him at all. You're the one always that has something to lose. He never does. He never does. And that's what seemingly is, to me, such a surprise. We're on the dangerous side of the battle, even though we win. And we must not forget that the devil regards his organization as an army. And he sees us as the enemy. Because we are automatically, as Christians, placed in the army of the Lord and determined and classified soldiers of Christ. There's not a day. And Paul talks here, again, I'll read this to you. Verse 13, take unto you the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. Not every day. Well, I believe not every day will be a day of conflict with the devil. Not open conflict. They will, I believe, plot a day of evil for you. They will orchestrate and organize and control and manipulate people and situations, and they will set you up for a certain temptation on a certain day. I think that's how sometimes people who are in seances and hooked in with demons can give some predictions. If the devil has plotted something to happen and then tells one of his seance buddies what he has plotted to plan, then that person can predict into the future what's going to happen. Because the devil's going to make it happen. Now, they can't always work it true because, you see, what the devil never realizes is the Christian can foul up everything through prayer and fighting the devil. That's the one thing that totally surprises the devil. He doesn't know what you're going to do. He thinks he knows. He pretty well knows us like a book. But you can surprise him. And so there is an evil day plan and an evil day plot. I look back at David, who was said to be a man to God's own heart. And I believe the devil began to manipulate situations and circumstances around the life of David. Always the king would lead his army into battle. Why on this day did David not go into battle the first time? Why? It was not that he was sick. It was not that he did not have a heart for war. Why did David this day decide not to go into battle? He should have thought that was kind of strange. I would. Now with that, why did David decide to take a trip up on the roof at a certain time of that day? And why did it just happen at that very time that David went up there that the next door neighbor, Bathsheba, was taking a bath on her roof? Were all these just mere coincidences? Chances of that happening were a million to one? No, I think it was all orchestrated way, way back there. And the devil laid his plans and laid his plot. And set his time, and set the day of evil, and said, we've got David in a trap. And I believe if we pull it off, we'll catch him. And he'll fall, and he'll sin, and he'll get in trouble with God, and he'll lose his blessing. I believe we can do it if we do it like this. And I don't know how they persuaded him to stay home, how they got him up on the roof, how they got her there at that very moment. How all this transpired, I don't know. But it wasn't just a coincidence. Not just a coincidence. Now, had David been able to see and hear the evil spirits planning and plotting, I don't think they'd ever caught him. I don't think he would have ever stayed home, or he would not have gone on the roof. Gone on the roof, he wouldn't look the word Bathsheba and kept on looking. I mean, I think David would have totally done the opposite had he had advanced notice that this is what was going on. But we're told Satan is going to set us up. And he does have more power than a lot of us want to give him credit for. And they picked the time, the day, and the place, and the situation to bring him down. Now, Jesus told Peter, Peter, the devil is out to sift you as wheat. I'm telling you, he's setting you up. Now, we wonder, well, Jesus, why didn't you tell the devil he couldn't do that? And Jesus, in a sense, says, why don't you tell him? I mean, I give you authority to do battle with the devil and to gain victory. I mean, you can do it. Through my name, through my power, I'll help you. I mean, but you take the initiative. You're the soldier. I give you the equipment. I arm you. Now you go do it. But Peter did not know what Jesus was talking about until a few days later. He found out that Satan set him up to make him deny Jesus three times, to lie, by threatening his life. Peter didn't believe Jesus. But Jesus had knowledge of the plot. Now, had Peter known the plot, I don't think he'd ever gone to see Christ when he was tried. He'd never put himself in the place where he'd been asked three times, or had he done so, he would have told the truth and taken the consequences. Go back real quickly to, and I don't have much time for this, look at the devil's government. And I think he is an orchestrated, organized kingdom. Christ talks about kingdom come. Satan says, my kingdom has already come. We are waiting for Christ to come to rule this world. And Satan says, I'm already ruling this world. You have two definite kings, two definite princes, two definite kingdoms here. John 14:30, Jesus admits Satan is a prince, a ruler, a king. John 14:30. Howbeit, hereafter, I will not talk much with you. Now notice, Jesus says, for the prince of this world, that's the devil, comes, and he has nothing in me. That is, I have no connection whatsoever with him. Now, a prince has a throne, does he not? Jesus says, when he comes to reign and rule, he will rule on the throne in Jerusalem. A prince has a throne. Strange question. Look at Revelation 2:13. Jesus admits Satan establishes his throne on this earth. He says, I know thy works, and where thou dwellest, you dwell. This is a little church now. He says, you dwell where Satan's seat is. Huh. You dwell where Satan has placed his throne. We're talking here about Pergamos. In the city of Pergamos, Satan had decided to sit down and rule this world from that location. Why on earth Pergamos? I know where Satan's seat is, and he said, I know that you have held fast my name, has not denied my faith, and was slain, that is, Antipas, my faithful martyr, was slain among you where Satan dwells. Now, the devil can only be one place at one time. He is nothing but a fallen angel. Now, God is all places at all times, but I mean, he's everywhere. But Satan has to be one place at one time. I'm going to say, when Moses was alive, I would say that Satan made his headquarters Egypt. Just my thinking. He was the one that made Pharaoh so stupid and obstinate and filled him with lies. Yeah, I'll let your people go, then you lied. That sounds about something like Satan would do. And then during the days of Daniel, I would almost surmise that Babylon had been made the headquarters of the devil. He kind of moves around. During the days of Jesus, I don't know where we would be in headquarters. Probably Rome, but maybe in Jerusalem, because that's where Jesus would want to roam, rule. And you know where the Antichrist is going to set up the rule of Satan during the tribulation period? And the temple in Jerusalem. We know where he's going to end up trying to rule. How about today? Boy, we could have fun with that one, couldn't we? Where would Satan headquarter his operation today? We used to say, well, it'd probably be in Russia, communism. Where do you think it is today? Well, it's over there in Iraq. It's over there in North Korea. We say it's in America. I think if I was the devil, and I can't think like him and thank God for that, you know, I think I'd be in America. I really would. I could do more damage to the world right over here than I could anywhere else. I could upset the apple cart more here than anywhere else. I could do God more trouble right here than I could any other country that I can think of. I could really have myself a good time in this country. And that seems to be what's happening with what's taking place in our land today. But politically correct is Satan's program. You want to know it. Out with God and in with evil. Condone what is wrong and condemn what is right. I mean, you know, it's kind of scary. He's having more success in this country than he has ever had since its origin. That kind of bothers me. I'm not saying the devil's here in America. I don't know. I really don't know. But he's somewhere. A prince, if he's a prince, has the right to lay down laws. I'll close with this. Laws which he wants obeyed. Jesus was called the Prince of Peace, and he laid down laws. And he still does. And he wants them obeyed. Satan is a prince of the power of air. He also gives commands, and he wants his commands obeyed. And I believe it's the task of the army of his, the fallen angels, to make sure that his laws are well known. You and I had to be taught the law of God. Nowhere on the face of this earth does anyone have to be taught the law of sin. They all know it. All men know how to be evil. All men know how to disobey the commands of God. Even though no one has ever taught them what sin is, how to sin, what is wrong, and what is evil, they already know. How has Satan taught all these people to do what is wicked? None righteous, the Bible says, no, not one. All men are ungodly in the eyes of God. ungodly means they oppose His laws. We have to go into all the world and teach other people the gospel. Satan doesn't. They already have it. We have to go and correct their knowledge. We have to go, and Jesus said, I must tell them the truth, and the truth to what? Set them free. Who taught them all the lies? If you could take a little baby born today and set him on an island and he could be nourished, would that child grow up knowing the law of sin if nobody spoke to him for 20 years? Yes. How do you learn all that? How do you learn so much wrong? Evil spirits have the right to manipulate and work on and teach a mind. And man has a fallen nature. That helps a lot. You know, real receptive. And we don't have to go and teach people to do evil. We have to go and teach people they're doing evil. And that God says this is the way they should do. And this is the way they should act. Romans chapter 7, I'll close with this. Romans chapter 7. It's a familiar text of Paul. But he admits something here that I think illustrates that the prince of the power of error, Satan, does instill within us laws that he wants obeyed. He commands us to do that which is sin. Romans chapter 7, verse 19. Paul admits sin here. Says, the good that I would like to do, not. That is, the thing I do not want to do. I'll just kind of change this. The good that I would, I don't do it. There's a good that God tells me I ought to do, but I don't do it. And then there is evil which I know that I do not want to do, but I do it. I don't do what I want, and I do what I don't want. That sounds typical, doesn't it? Now, if you will, verse 21. I find there is a law operating in my life that when I want to do good, evil rears its head within me. I delight in the law of God after the inward man. There's a part of me that has a delight in the law of God, which had to be taught to him, by the way. Verse 23, but he says, I see there is another law. This is the law of sin. This is the law of Satan. This is the commandment of the devil, given to Paul, given to me, given unto you. We have two sets of thou shalt's. As Christians, one comes from God, the other comes from the devil. And he says here, I see there is another law operating in my life, in my body, in my mind. And I find that it's warring against the law of God. There is a warfare of thoughts taking place in my life. There are two people in me laying down the law. One saying, thou shalt not, and the other saying, thou shalt. And they're at war with each other. I find this battle going on in my mind. And the law of my mind is trying, that is the law of Satan, is trying to bring me into captivity to the law of sin. I'm being put under pressure to cave in and obey the law of sin instead of the law of God. That's spiritual warfare, people. There it is right there, spiritual warfare. You and I will obey one law or the other.